You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about cultural stereotypes on television and how the depiction of a character on The Simpsons has sparked a debate that caused the show to respond in a recent episode. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Lawmakers are backing a plan to dole out $26 million worth of funding to the UW system based partly on workforce needs. The U.S. Senate voted down a measure that would have changed regulations on ballast water for ships on the Great Lakes, and Vice President Mike Pence is coming to the state next week. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Thank you.
Let's check out some news from the UW system first, Rob. We've been following the ongoing story of proposed cuts at UW Stevens Point. It would get rid of a bunch of liberal arts majors, replace them in some cases with some other majors, UW Superior suspending programs last year. That's drawn backlash, and now some student demonstrators came from Stevens Point to Madison. Tell us about that.
Right. Yes. Students braved the snowy weather in Madison this week to do a march and to occupy Board of Regents offices to make their points about their opposition to the proposal in Stevens Point. They called the demonstration "Do Your Job, Protect the UW," and they had a list of demands, and we're just trying to sort of show their opposition to the proposal.
And that follows on protests they've had there at UW Stevens Point, right?
Right. A series of and some mobilization efforts by students and faculty to try to at least persuade the university leaders to look at other budget plans. I can't say that I know the status of those efforts, but it has been sort of all hands on deck among the humanities folks there.
And any response from the Board of Regents about the concerns being raised here?
Well, I mean, to some extent, I think they're expecting this sort of response. They've seen this building. The chancellor in Stevens Point has been sort of, in his public statements, has been sort of positive about the students' activism and the way that the students are sort of making their voice heard here, at the same time that he is not showing a lot of movement on the substance of the policies. Although, as I say, it's a bit hard to know. And I think that's kind of a general, you might generalize that with the regents, sort of some support of students' rights here without quite a lot of sympathy for the cause.
Also in UW system news, the state's Joint Finance Committee approved a plan submitted by the UW Board of Regents that says, hey, here's how we're going to distribute the $26 million worth of performance-based funding that lawmakers passed. What do we know about what they're doing?
Right. So this is, this is part of the Republicans' state budget that passed last year. And this was, the sort of plan was endorsed by the Board of Regents in December. So, what happened this week was the University Committee approved a plan for dividing this pot of money. Total state funding for the UW system is something like $70 million a year. And then of that amount, there's a pot of $26 million that's going to be divided up by campuses based on these different metrics, which is new. The metrics are based on things like student access, budget efficiency, and a somewhat controversial one, workforce contribution.
Yeah, what do they mean by that part?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of a general movement toward toward sort of treating the university as in an instrumental fashion, as a tool of the economy. So it's a way of encouraging students to go into STEM fields, into science and technology. And, to some extent, that is happening already because many students who go to college want to, are making their own judgments about the job market that they will enter as they come out. But I think it's also, it really is, it's very much consistent with what is happening at in Stevens Point, to some extent Superior too, where the emphasis is being placed on these science areas and perhaps business classes, other sorts of classes and humanities is de-emphasized in a way that some people object to. It's not whatever else it may be. It's not the it does contradict the old principle of the Wisconsin idea.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in state news. This one from the federal government, Rob. The U.S. Senate was considering a change to ballast water rules for ships that came up on the Great Lakes. They ended up not passing that. So what was going on here?
Right. So nothing actually changed this week, but from the perspective of like an environmentalist or activist, people who pay attention to these issues, this was seen as a very close call. It was a close vote, and just the fact that it was to a vote, some people are quite worried about. So basically, ballast water is you have these big giant ships that are going across the ocean and bringing us, toys or clothing made in Asia and imported. Those ships take on ballast water to help to sort stabilize them as they go across the ocean. And then if they dump out that water into Lake Michigan or wherever, in the process they may have brought over invasive species or bad germs or bad plants or whatever. I mean, it's not a hypothetical. This is exactly how scientists think that invasive species like zebra mussels got into the Great Lakes. So there is obviously a huge potential environmental impact to that. And what the actual bill that was considered was would have taken the responsibility for regulating that and monitoring that away from the Environmental Protection Agency and given it to the U.S. Coast Guard, which is not really an environmental agency. And so that was the concern, was that they wouldn't be able they would have no idea, they wouldn't be able to effectively monitor what was coming into the Great Lakes.
So the EPA stays in charge of ballast water. How did Wisconsin senators end up voting on this?
Oh, party line. The old standby. Senator Tammy Baldwin, a Democrat, voted against the change. Senator Ron Johnson, a Republican, voted for it. Johnson's argument is that it streamlines regulation. This is something that the shipping industry wanted. States still have the right to pass their own, regulations on this. So his case against it would have been more this is red tape and there are other ways to achieve the same end. But Baldwin's argument is we should be a little careful about the stuff we're bringing into the Great Lakes.
And finally, Rob, Vice President Mike Pence scheduled to come to Wisconsin next Wednesday. What's he stopping by for?
He's going to talk tax reform. He's going to tout the Republican tax reform plan that is the major legislative achievement of this Congress in a public forum in Milwaukee. Then you will headline a fundraiser that evening for Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
And is this a sign, do you think, Rob, that national Republicans are watching not just our U.S. Senate race, which we know there's a lot of attention from out of the state on, but also the race for governor here in the state?
Sure. I mean, we're gearing up here. Walker traditionally has had no problem getting a lot of money from big dollar Republican donors. But he is—he's been out publicly talking about the from his view, the risk of a blue wave this fall, and so he is beginning that fundraising effort in earnest. Pence and Walker are kind of peas in a pod in a way. A couple of Midwestern governors, social conservatives, their experience is somewhat similar, so it makes sense for a high-profile Republican who would want to lend support for Walker. In some ways, probably makes more sense for it to be Pence than for it to be President Trump.
Rob, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That's Rob Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor at the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's with us pretty much every Friday to recap news from around the state. there's an ongoing back and forth controversy surrounding The Simpsons character Apu, voiced by actor Hank Azaria, and the show's depiction of what some people are saying are cultural stereotypes.
Pardon me, but I would like to see this money spent on more police officers. I have been shot 8 times this year, and as a result, I almost missed work.
Comedian Hari Kondabolu created a documentary called The Problem with Apu and talked to several actors and comedians of South Asian descent about how they are represented in pop culture, and The Simpsons responded in a recent episode. Aisha Harris writes about culture for Slate and hosts the Slate podcast Represent. She recently wrote a piece about the Apu debate. Aisha, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, can you first give us some of the issues raised in that documentary, The Problem with Apu?
Sure. Essentially, the documentary that Hari Kondabolu did was about the long history of the lack of representation of Indian Americans in pop culture and TV and the news everywhere. And he came at it from a personal stance of having grown up loving The Simpsons, but being kind of ashamed of the fact that the only Indian American character on that show was a very stereotypical Indian American character, and it was the only thing that he had to look to as representation at that time. And it, to add insult to injury, it's the concoction, the character is the concoction of a group of white creators as well as is voiced by a white actor. And so when you have this sort of animated brown face performance happening, it kind of lends itself to many stereotypes that have been hurtful and have had a large influence on the representation of Indian Americans for decades now.
Hari Kondabolu was a guest on your podcast recently. We have a clip from your conversation with him. Here it is.
It's still The Simpsons. It's still one of the most important shows. It's still on the air.
Mm-hmm.
It influenced a generation of young comedians and writers, a generation of comedy fans, TV fans. Like, you can't ignore that. And so if it's that influential, then a character that is a caricature, you know, and is a minstrel character done by, you know, it's paint and it's brown paint and a white man's voice.
Mm.
The fact that's still on the air, at least we should be critical. Like, how did we allow for it 30 years ago? Why is it still on now and are we okay with it? And what impact does that make? I mean, the thing is, I think our institutional memory is very short. And we forget that a lot of the things we're doing now have happened before or are mutants of previous racism. Racism mutates from era to era. It doesn't look the way it used to look.
And Aisha, talk about that, the influence of The Simpsons. A lot of the actors and comedians he talked about, you know, auditioning or getting parts and having directors coach them to do accents like Apu.
Right, which, if I recall correctly, in the documentary, one of the people he interviews says, you know, that's not a real accent. Like, no one actually talks like this. And so having that sort of be the only thing that people can think of when they think of Indian American actors or South Asian actors is really, really sad. And some would argue that the character, all the Simpsons characters are one-dimensional, but when you have one Indian-American character and you have all these other characters who are all, I mean, they're yellow, but they're ostensibly white, that's when it becomes a problem. There weren't other representations. We have more representation now, but even though we have more representation now, that doesn't mean that the character is still problematic because, again, it's still being voiced by Hank Azaria.
Right. You touched on, I think, a lot of the reaction I saw as I looked at, you know, YouTube comments, which I often try not to do. But in response pieces to the documentary was saying Apu is a stereotypical one-dimensional character on a show packed with stereotypical one-dimensional characters. That's kind of the point they're arguing. You don't buy that, though.
No, I don't buy it. And I think, you know, the way in which the creators have not really done much to reckon with that. Like, they've added other Indian American characters in recent years, but they haven't been necessarily regular characters. And I think that even if they were to get rid of them today, like, Apu will still linger. Like, I think the damage is still very much going to remain for a very long time.
Talking to Aisha Harris. She writes for Slate, talking about a controversy, a back and forth over the character of Apu in The Simpsons and wider issues of how people of different ethnic backgrounds are represented in pop culture. Last week, The Simpsons addressed the Apu criticism, kind of responded, I think without naming it, to the Problem with Apu documentary, with Lisa Simpson directly facing into the camera, or what would be the camera if it weren't animated. Here's a snippet from the scene.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
It's hard to say. Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do?
Some things will be dealt with at a later date.
If at all.
And a lot of people looked at that, and this is why this is back in the news. The Simpsons reaction almost got as much attention as the documentary itself. What are people making of that sort of response within the confines of the show?
I mean, I think that most people kind of don't buy that sort of shrugging. Essentially what the show was doing was it was saying, yeah, we know that people find this problematic, but, you know, there's nothing we can do. There's no way to deal with this. We're just going to keep doing what we do. And I think it also says there's a stigma around being, quote unquote, politically correct, and it's thumbing its nose at political correctness. But I don't think political correctness is necessarily a bad thing. And I also think that this goes beyond that, in that there are a lot of people who have been hurt by this, whether personally or professionally, as the documentary makes a case for. Like, a lot of there's still so much progress to be made for South Asian actors to be represented on screen. And I think that in many ways, the Simpsons is refusing to reckon with its history, and it's just saying, eh, what are you going to do?
And I think that's a response from a lot of people who consume TV and movies is, eh, whatever, does it really matter? It's just TV or a movie. Why, Aisha, does representation matter, big picture?
I mean, it matters because it influences our daily lives, whether subconsciously or not. As a Black person, the images that are seen on screen of Black women like myself, if, you know, in the mid-aughts, there were a lot of sort of negative representations, especially in reality shows, of the angry Black woman or the Black woman who rolled her neck. Like, that gets transferred into the way other people in the real world might see me before I even open my mouth. And sometimes it can mean the matter of, you know, getting a job or life or death. Like, these things are, pop culture is not frivolous. It is part of our culture, and it very much informs our daily lives. So I think that's one of the biggest reasons why representation in general just matters. And that's why people like myself are so eager to see wider representations of ourselves in TV, film, music, everywhere.
Is that starting to happen? Because in the documentary, The Problem with Apu, there were people that I think a lot of people have heard of for Hari Kondabolu to talk to about this, people of South Asian origin in pop culture. There are more African-American showrunners out there now, it seems like. Are you seeing more and different types of characters starting to show up on TV?
Oh, for sure. I mean, this has been happening for the last 5 or 6 years now, or even longer, really. I think the Shonda effect, which is named after Shonda Rhimes, who's creator of Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, I think that that's a real thing, and the influence of her having very diverse casts has trickled down into media. At the same time, I'm always very cautiously optimistic about these things because we have seen moments in the past, not of South Asian performers per se, but of Black people in particular who thrived on TV and TV shows in the 90s and in the 70s, and then it receded, and there was like a good decade or so where there were hardly any Black-led sitcoms or TV shows on network TV. So I think that we're in a good space now, and we can keep moving forward, hopefully, but I'm also very aware that it could all be sort of pulled away or receded at any time.
How much of it is just having a sheer numbers of characters represented? Because if Apu is the only representation of a South Asian character on TV, if Black Widow is the only woman in the Avengers, that puts a lot of weight on that one character.
Exactly. And, you know, it's it shouldn't be that way. And like I said, there are definitely more South Asian actors who are working today, and that's a great thing. But, you know, there's still this incongruity between having something like Master of None or, you know, Kamal Nanjiani, who directed The Big Sick, or who wrote in The Big Sick, but then also still having a major network show in which an Indian character is played by a white man. Like, that shouldn't be happening still.
And Hari Kondabolu making this documentary, he'd been a Simpsons fan for his life and then was rethinking it here, especially based on this one character. Had you been a Simpsons fan yourself, Aisha?
I have not watched The Simpsons or a full episode of The Simpsons in like a decade, maybe. And I was never a huge fan, but I've definitely, you know, I appreciate it. I appreciate what it's brought to the culture and some of the very smart ways in which they've riffed on culture, and I think that, you know, it's a legacy. It is a big show, but I do wonder if its time has come. I think even the most ardent Simpsons fans are not the biggest fans of the latest seasons.
We'll leave it there for now. Aisha, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Aisha Harris writes about culture for Slate. She also hosts the Slate podcast Represent. We've been talking about a recent controversy surrounding the Simpsons character Apu. And you can hear an interview with Hari Kondabolu on WPR's new show Beta. You can check out the program archive at WPR.org. Now, Bon-Ton confirmed this week that the company is shutting down after nearly 120 years in business. They operated stores like Boston and Yonkers, and the news means that more than 2,200 workers in Wisconsin will lose their jobs. 250 stores will close around the country. Hart Posen is an associate professor of management and human resources at the University of Wisconsin School of Business. He's with us now to talk about what the closure says about the retail industry. Hart, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, Bon-Ton,
every time someone goes bankrupt, you call.
You're the guy we call now, yeah. So Bon-Ton owned a bunch of different stores under a bunch of different names. In a nutshell, what happened?
You know, Bon-Ton has been in trouble for some time now. You know, they have a bunch of different names. Some of them you know, some of them you don't know, that have been acquired over the years. And, you know, really the fundamental problem at Bon-Ton was there was nothing distinctive about them. They weren't low price. They didn't have the best selection. They didn't have the best customer service. There was nothing that would make you really go in to a Bon-Ton store.
Is this part of a story of online shopping, Amazon in particular, is killing brick-and-mortar retail, or is there a lot more to it than that?
I think there's more to it than that. There's no doubt that the online part is part of it, but Bon-Ton would have been in trouble, I think, regardless. There's certainly huge changes going on in retail right now. Part of it is about figuring out how to mix in online and brick and mortar. But at the same time, there's no reason to believe that brick and mortar is going away.
What are some of the successful stores that are doing okay in brick and mortar now?
Yeah, there are plenty of stores doing reasonably well. The discounters, the TJ Maxx's and Ross Dress for Less, they're doing very well. And those discount versions of Nordstrom's, Nordstrom's Rack, for instance, they're doing quite well. So those types of folks are doing well. They're distinctively sort of low price, but with this sort of hunt and gather kind of feel to it. Best Buy is doing reasonably well as well. Kohl's is doing reasonably well as sort of the big Wisconsin success story.
So what's a store like Kohl's doing right? They have to have something unique, I guess. What is it there?
Yeah, you know, compared to the Bon-Tons of the world, but the others who are in sort of our traditional sort of shopping malls, a lot of the Kohl's stores are newer. They're in these sort of large strip mall locations that are closer to where people are living now, easier to get in and out of. So I think part of Kohl's success, it comes down to their more appropriate locations, but also part of it comes down to the way they've been able to mix in online and in stores to continually draw people into the stores with a good mix of regular price and discounts. Kohl's is doing a lot of things right now.
Now, where do the Targets and especially Walmarts of the world fit in here?
Yeah, so particularly Walmart is doing pretty well. Target is holding its own. They're in a bit of a different fight and a more sort of direct fight with Amazon. Walmart has been, you know, Walmart can't grow by opening more Walmart stores. They're already within 10 minutes of most of us. They need to grow online. They've been fighting really hard to do that. A few years ago, they bought an online startup called Jet.com for like $3 billion. And it was mostly to hire the founder of Jet.com to run their online business. And they've made some progress in sort of competing online against Amazon.
Talking to Hart Posen from the UW Business School, Bon-Ton is liquidating, selling off its stores. That has an impact on shoppers here in Wisconsin, and people who work at their stores and one of their two headquarters in Milwaukee. Their Boston store, the first Boston store in Milwaukee, it's going to go away. Long tradition there. A downtown store. And I've seen in places, you know, Chicago, they're bringing stores in downtown. It seems like there's a retail experience coming back to downtown, but that doesn't always pan out for places.
You know, it pans out when that experience is an experience that you can't have someplace else. So if you want to see where that's going on around here, it's going on at Hilldale in Madison, for instance, right? Where not that, you know, it was 2011-12, the owner of that property was in bankruptcy. And so they've made sort of a unique experience that you can't get elsewhere. The part of the problem with the malls, East Town, West Town, they're the same. East Town, Madison, West Town, Madison, some other town, same stores, same experience, no good reason to get out of bed and go.
Yeah, let's talk about the shopping malls. And I used to think growing up, if you knocked me out and put me on the floor of a mall anywhere in the country, it would take me a while to figure out what city I was in because they really do all look the same. And a lot of the Bon-Ton stores, they were anchor stores for the traditional shopping malls, if I could say that. What is happening at our malls now?
You know, that problem that you described, the sort of the homogeneity of these malls, that's certainly gotten worse and worse. In part, it was the mall owner's own doing, right? They didn't want local retailers in those malls. They preferred regional and national players because they could sign a deal with you for not one location, but 10 locations or 100 locations. And so they made themselves homogenous, and as long as there was no other competition, it wasn't a problem.
Is there something about us, our psychology, that's changing? Because when I was a teen, we would go and hang out at the mall. Probably didn't spend enough to sustain the mall, but people would go out for a day of shopping at the mall, go to the anchor store, maybe a couple specialty stores, maybe hit the food court. Do we want to do that kind of thing anymore?
You know, that's a tough and broad question. I think the way people socialize, certainly the way kids socialize, is changing. But I think there's, you know, per your story of, you know, in Chicago on Michigan Avenue or in Madison these days in Hilldale, people do want to go do that. If we, meaning the mall owners, the store owners, give them a good reason to. If they don't give us a reason, we can just easily stay home and shop on Amazon.
Are there more upscale stores? You mentioned the discount stores doing pretty well. Are there upscale stores or mid to upscale stores that are doing a good job at in and of themselves being that experience for people to shop at?
I think there are a variety of chains that are doing a decent job. You see North Face stores. People want to go into a North Face store. Because they can tell that it's distinct from the goods in other stores. But if you walk into a Gap or an Abercrombie, can you tell them apart? And the answer is definitely no. So there are folks doing well. Best Buy has done a really nice job of using the store as a complement to buying to folks buying online. There's some touch and feel that you can get by going into a Best Buy. And, you know, you saw it this week, actually, because Amazon announced that their new Fire line of televisions will be available in Best Buy stores, so people can go look and touch and feel.
So we can buy our Amazon products not online.
Yes, yes. Isn't that great?
Now, I want to bring up a couple more anchor stores at malls, Sears and JCPenney's. I know Penny's in particular has gone through some efforts to reinvent itself. We're not going to get rid of coupons. Oh, my God, nobody's shopping here anymore. We're going back to coupons. What is the future for those big and long-running lines of stores?
Yeah, you know, I'm betting against Sears. My bet would be Sears will disappear mostly. JCPenney might survive. JCPenney's been doing a better job. You know, your comment on getting rid of coupons at JCPenney had to do with a few years ago, JCPenney hiring the marketing experience person from Apple,
right,
trying to make it more Apple-ish. That didn't go anywhere, and very quickly they got rid of that person and decided, no, our real competitor, Kohl's. And Kohl's is their real competitor now.
Now, I wonder about kind of coupon and sale culture. There's been a concern, and part of the concern, I think, with JCPenney's was that, okay, great, we've trained our customers to never buy things at full price, to wait for the coupon, wait for the sale. Is that something that's come back to bite companies in the rear?
You know, that's something that comes back to bite lots of companies. The company that famously paid the price for that and continues to pay the price is The Gap. I don't know about you, but I think I told you offline here, I buy my 6 pairs of Gap jeans once a year after Christmas at 50% off. And so they do train us, and they train us with outlet stores and other things, and it's hard to recover from that. I think folks who do that quite well have been Kohl's once again, who have used sort of discount pricing, smart discount pricing, to get people in the door.
And that's entered into Wisconsin and national politics because of Governor Walker.
Yes, that's right.
We're talking to Hart Posen, Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources at the UW School of Business, talking about the end of Bon-Ton, the parent company of Boston Store and Yonkers, among many others. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 about how you shop. Are you still shopping at department stores? If not, why did you stop? If so, which ones do you go to? What keeps you coming back to a store? Do you have memories of shopping at the big Boston store in Milwaukee? And do you work for Bon-Ton? What is happening to you now? Do you work at another retailer that you're worried about the future there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about the liquidation of Bon-Ton and what it says about the changing retail industry and how you shop. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you working in the retail industry, worried about what recent closures might mean for you? Are you a shopper? Do you still go to department stores, big box stores, the mall? Are you shifting more to online? What does it take to get you into a store? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Hart Posen stays with us from the UW School of Business. To your calls now, Sean is on the line in Madison. Sean, hi.
Hi. I've found that I'm a 49-year-old male, and the experience in a store is what draws me there. Cabela's, REI, specialty stores. I like to go there for the experience, to make my larger purchases. But I have found that Amazon has become the place that I go for, like, my $10 and under items, because I don't have to run around town looking for a specialty item that's less than $10. I can go on Amazon, buy them, and have them shipped in a couple of days. So that's my comment.
Sean, thanks a lot for that call. Let's talk about that experience he's talking about. I mean, Cabela's is a store. Like, I know a lot of people in my family, they're excited when the Cabela's opens up in a town near them.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. Cabela's is another good example of a retailer giving you a reason to go in. Although, you know, I would say that increasingly, it's not just the reason to go in, because you can also shop at Cabela's online. It is that the online experience and the reason to go in are complementary, that they work together to drive sales.
And with branding, I think if you go to a Cabela's, and there are probably other stores like this REI he mentioned too, It's not just shopping. It's also kind of a statement about who you are when you shop if they've done this branding successfully.
Yeah, and I think that's right. That's more traditional, though, right? That's one way area where the youth retailers, the Abercrombies, have run into trouble is that eventually there were so many of them they were so similar. So. You know, that statement about who you are, that I'm a Cabela shopper, that says something about you, I think that can be, it is in their case, very important.
Could Kohl's fit in that category where, as again with Governor Walker, talking about using that Kohl's cash and getting that sweater for a buck? I mean, is that a identity statement like I'm a frugal shopper if I go there? Do people define themselves that way?
Can't really speak to that. Okay. I shop at Kohl's. I am frugal, but you know, it's not the kind of identity in the same way as a Cabela shopper would have.
Well,
an Apple shopper, for that matter.
We can delve into your psychology a little more here. Maybe.
I think we need professional help.
All right, back to our callers now. Thanks for that call. Anne is with us in Eau Claire. Anne, hi.
Hi. I just was going to comment about that sense of memory and place that you guys are talking about. Going to Grand Avenue in Milwaukee in the 80s and 90s was such a special time for family, and also when I got older with friends. And then, you know, you had to buy your concert tickets sometimes at the Boston store. So I live up north now, but that was, you know, the mall was the place to be and a special place around Christmas time. So it really brings back a lot of memories, and sad that they couldn't make it work, but I think that we're heading in a different direction. I shop online, and I still go to the mall.
And thanks a lot for that call. So that's the family experience, the friends experience that people used to have at the mall.
Yeah, and, you know, that went away in the last, you know, decade or so, that we no longer felt that way about going there. But, you know, there are places that still make us feel that way. I go to Chicago and we go to Michigan Avenue. You still feel that way going there. It can be done. But someone's got to get up and they have to build it like that.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Susie with us in Mequon. Susie, hi.
Hi. I kind of am echoing what I just heard the other two people say. You know, part of shopping is being out there. I want to touch things. I want to feel them. I want to know what I'm buying. And when I see it online, I have to just trust that it's polyester and cotton, or it's cotton and silk, but I don't know what the size is. I don't know if it's going to fit me. And it is part of socialization. Do we all want to just sit in our houses and do, you know, it's fun to be out with people.
Susie, thanks a lot for that call. A lot of people feel the way Susie does. Clearly, though, Hart, a lot of people don't.
That's exactly right. And even some people who feel that way will still go and buy stuff online because it's convenient and it's easy. Retailers need to make us want to feel that way and make us feel that way when we come out. Some are doing it, many are not.
And that's the stores that are failing, that are closing. They are not keeping up with that need?
Oh, Bon-Ton is, I think, and their set of stores is a prime example of someone who wasn't offering us anything distinctive that we would want to get in our cars and drive to.
We'll leave it there, Hart. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Hart Posen. He's an associate professor of management and human resources at the University of Wisconsin School of Business, talking about the retail landscape after this week's announcement. The Bon-Ton Stores, the company that operates Boston Store, Yonkers, and many others, liquidating their assets. A lot of impact on shoppers and workers around Wisconsin. This year, Wisconsin Public Radio is going beyond the ballot, asking Wisconsinites what's on their minds this election season. Friends Haley Pucker and Dana Gerber-Margie of Madison both graduated from college during the recession, and they're still feeling the financial strain. They sat down with WPR News to talk about this issue and more.
Do you plan to vote in this fall's election?
I do.
Okay, why?
Sometimes it seems like voting is one of the few ways that I can actually do something. It feels like I don't have a lot of power, but that vote carries the power I actually do have to, you know, get my voice out there and to get my opinion out there and perhaps actually cause change. Are you going to vote? in this fall's election, Dana?
I do plan to vote. I think I'm going to plan to vote for the rest of my life in every election.
And why? Why do you vote?
I don't have much money, so the one thing that it feels like I can do more than donate large amounts of cash to organizations that are important to me, it feels like I can vote for people who think and feel similarly to me, even if I feel a little cynical, a lot cynical, yeah, about our democracy.
One of the things we get really worked up about and care about is healthcare in this country. Just trying to maneuver through the healthcare system. And I was in an accident in fall. I was biking home and an SUV hit me. I flew onto the sidewalk. An ambulance came and I was bleeding. I was bruised. I was cut. And they said, well, we don't think anything's broken, but do you want us to take you to the emergency room? We think you should go in. But as I was sitting in the ambulance, I did not think, oh, you know, like, did I break something? Are my intestines okay? Like, right, my internal organs? All I could think was, what's my copay to go to the emergency room? And how much does an ambulance ride cost? And no one should think that in my mind. No one should be hurt or sick and worry about what it's going to cost. Dana, what was it like entering the real world after college? I know we've talked about this a lot.
Oh, my God. It was awful. During the time I was at college, the recession happened. And then I couldn't find stable, full-time work with benefits, with anything. I cobbled together 5 part-time jobs. And then I listened as old people told me I didn't work hard enough. And I never saw a way out.
It's funny, I still don't feel like I've entered the real world almost. I know that sounds so dumb. Like,
I only feel like I'm recovering.
Yeah.
Do you think one of the reasons that you don't feel like you've entered the real world is because of your student loans?
Yeah. about half of my income every month goes to student loan bills. I live by the calendar to a scary amount. I know, the 22nd, this $400 loan is due. The 28th, this one is due. Like, I'm never not thinking about money.
If I didn't feel so tired all the time,
right,
I feel like I could do so much more. And I feel so tired because my mind is always thinking about money and inequality, my student loan debt and my health care and how I fit into it. And
it's exhausting.
To see more stories like this one or to share your own story, visit WPR.org/ballot.